24th, 2013, and this is the Hermetic Hour with your host, Pope Runyon. And tonight, we present a discussion on the Sufis and Islamic mysticism. Now, this is a subject that is impossible to fathom and difficult to summarize. Now, the reason it is so difficult to understand lies in Sufism's passion for non-literal, allegorical, and paradoxical teaching, derived in part from its fear of being persecuted by Orthodox Islam for heresy, a very real fear which endangers Sufi circles all over the world at the present time. We will briefly outline the history of Sufism and highlight the work of some of its legendary teachers with their profound and sometimes humorous parables. And we will recall the famous Rubaiyat of Umar Khayyam, comparing the Western version to what Khayyam actually wrote. And Gurdjieff's debt to Sufism will be noted. We'll outline the so-called Arabic Kabbalah, sometimes called Abjad, and discuss the controversial book, The Other Islam, on present-day Sufism by Stephen Schwartz. So, if you want to find out what you don't know about the Sufis, tune in and be mystified. Okay. Well, Sufism has some things in common with Zen Buddhism. I know that that may sound a little strange, but they actually does. And Zen Buddhism was equally obscure and until finally it got to be kind of a popular thing. But Zen Buddhism, the great proponent of Zen Buddhism was D.T. Suzuki, this Japanese scholar and philosopher. They invited him very early in the Beatnik, well, in the Beatnik era, back in the 50s, 60s, early 60s, late 50s, they invited D.T. Suzuki over to UCLA to give a lecture on Zen Buddhism, and which was all the rage among the Beatniks. And so they packed the Lyceum with a couple thousand people, and D.T. Suzuki came out in his robe, and he bowed to the audience, and he said, "Zen Buddhism, very hard to understand. Thank you." And then he went back through the curtains, and that was the end of the lecture. Well, Sufism is very hard to understand sometimes. We're going to try to lift the veil on it a little bit and give you an idea of what it is. Now, Sufism, as you probably know, is the mystical side of Islam. And although there are some Sufis, or would be technically termed neo-Sufis, who allow non-Muslims into their groups and their circles, and they like to contend that Sufism can be universal. It doesn't have to be Islamic, they say, although obviously it has its roots in Islam. But that's a small percentage of Sufis, and they're here in the West, of course, but almost entirely. But over in Islamic countries, Sufis are Muslims, and they have to be Muslims if they're going to be in the Sufi orders in the East. This is essential. So I want to make that clear to begin with. That some of the groups that call themselves Sufis would not be called Sufis by the Sufis, and I'm referring to the Golden Sufi Center and our One that I very much like, who's passed on now, Idris Shah, and of course he comes in all kinds of criticisms from Orthodox Sufis, and he was originally born in Afghanistan and went to England, and he wrote several very, very fine, I think, very good books on Sufism. And in fact, I'll mention a couple of those right now that we're going to discuss from tonight. Idris Shah wrote The Sufis, and this was published by Doubleday Anchor Books and had an introduction by Robert Graves. Idris Shah is an Afghan. He claimed to be a sheikh of one of the Afghan Sufi orders, and he went to England. He wrote several books on the occult, on the Western occult magic too, and so he is able to describe Sufism to Westerners because he's been a Westerner long enough. And so I would recommend The Sufis as a good survey book. I know that those people who are into Islamic Sufism don't like it, including Stephen Schwartz. And by the way, Stephen Schwartz's book, The Other Islam, we're going to get into that a little bit later. That's a book that I also very, very much recommend. But Stephen Schwartz, of course, having converted to Islam, got into Sufism over in the Balkans before and after the Balkan War. And so he converted to Islam, and he is a member of a couple of Sufi orders. And we'll discuss that book as we get on into it. But let's talk about what Sufism is. First place, Sufism grew up out of the original practice of Islam. Although the Neo-Sufis claim that there were Sufis before Islam, and it incorporates ancient traditions that predate Islam and all of that, well, that's, you know, it does to some extent, yeah, but Sufism is a direct outgrowth of Islam, and the reason why that is this. Sufism is not magic, although occasionally in its history it's delved into magic, but they don't. Most Sufis don't want to have anything to do with the magic, really. They and most Sufis actually do follow Sharia, and they're devout. And so they're not, even though some orders, like some of the old Gnostics, are like to kick over the traces but most Sufi orders are very devout. And the reason what they really are mystics. They're not magicians. And what they strive for in their rituals and in their teaching, they strive for what we call enlightenment, and they strive for perfecting their lives. They want to be perfect men and women. It's primarily oriented toward men, but there have been some lady Sufis, and there are some Sufis and one in Afghanistan that I think is led by a woman. And they want to perfect themselves as servants of God and humankind. And they're very peaceful. They're very loving. Love is to them the most important aspect of harmony and enlightenment and perfection. And this, of course, is considerably different than their arch enemies, the Wahhabis, and we'll get into that a little bit later. Stephen Schwartz gets into that perhaps a little too much, but understand that the Sufis are almost all of them are very, very peaceful and loving, and not, they are not unfriendly to the West. They're exclusive, yes, and they have to, and they're real Sufis. They're devout Muslims, but they are not. They are absolutely not on a jihad against the West. They're our friends, and we should realize that Sufi mysticism is perhaps the opposite of Wahhabi dogma. But the reason why Sufism is an outgrowth of Islam, and let's be really honest and straightforward about this. Islam is a religion that is at its, in it, the way it's constructed and the way it is practiced, is a religion that exemplifies and encourages mysticism. More so than Judaism, more so than Christianity, and not more so than Tantric Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, but more so than regular Buddhism. The reason why it is this way is that, number one, the theology of Islam is all concentrated on the worship and the complete submission to the ineffable, one and only and ineffable and all-present God. It's completely monotheistic, although the Sunnis, of course, would argue that the Shiites are, you know, getting kind of polytheistic with their veneration of various imams, like Imam Hussein and whatever. But that's splitting hairs. Essentially, Islam, Mohammed did not deify. He didn't deify himself, and fortunately, nobody deified him. Whereas Jesus, even though Jesus may not have actually tried to deify himself, but his followers and those who made Christianity the state religion of the Roman Empire, they certainly did deify him. And he's been deified ever since. This is not something that Muhammad did. Muhammad was the prophet. And he, of course, also considered that Jesus was the prophet also. So as a result, God himself, not Muhammad, God is, Allah is everything. Allah is the compassionate. Allah is the all-embracing. Allah is the great spirit of the universe. And because of this, and the way Islam it insists that you pray five times a day, get down on your knees, face Mecca, and pray five times a day. Now, you know, those of us who really think about religion and think about magic, think about mysticism, those of us who are really awake and thinking about this, you have to realize that any group of people who are going to get down on their knees five times during the day and pray to a god are going to have 10 times the religious power of people who just go to church on Sunday morning, or maybe even people who go to church on Sunday morning and say their prayers for their kids at night, like a lot of Christians do, or most Christians do. In fact, most Christians don't even go to church on Sunday, but they go on Easter. this five times a day praying, this is the power. This is the power of Islam. Now, I am not witnessing for Islam here, and I'm not saying I'm in favor of this or anything like that, but I'm just saying as an anthropologist, I'm just looking at this thing and I'm just saying, yes, this is a huge religion with well over a billion people, and so many of them. So far more of them than are Jewish neighbors and our Christian neighbors, far more of them are doing this. The percentage of Muslims that are getting down on their knees and praying five times a day is really, really quite large. And so this is their power, and this is mystical. What this does is it creates an altered state of consciousness, and it maintains it. And it puts them into a different mindset, a spiritual mindset, that we don't understand because we're not in it. And we could be. You know,
I will tell people, hey, you know, you want to transform yourself? Say 1,000 times a day, through me flows a river of unlimited love. Okay, you say that 1,000 times a day, and I guarantee you, after a month, you'll be a different person. I guarantee it. That's the same thing. This is, now, you can call it magic if you want to, because we use techniques like that in magic. We do. But essentially, it's not magic, really. It's mysticism. Now, what is the mystical experience? The classic mystical experience, okay. Evelyn Underhill wrote a book about it, and Walter Stace also wrote a book about it. Stace's book is a little shorter and more to the point. So we'll quote Stace. According to Walter Stace, scholar that he is, and I don't know whether he ever did this himself, but he says that the mystical experience is an experience of undifferentiated unity with God. Now, he's right. And I didn't quite know what that meant, really. I never did quite know what undifferentiated unity with God was until I did it. I've done it a couple of times, and it is it's an overwhelming, wonderful feeling. You feel like you are one with the universe, and it isn't you know everything, even though you don't care whether you know everything or not. It's not necessary because you know everything anyway, and you just the center of the universe, and the entire universe is around you, and you are it. And it is an overwhelming, it's an excruciatingly beautiful experience. Now, this is the classic definition of mysticism, as opposed to seeing visions and, seeing the angels or seeing the spirits or whatever, and having them talk to you and having the, and that's mystical, but because in order to be magical, you'd have to go ahead and will that to happen, whereas the mystical experience quite often is a result of literally a result of prayer. Christian mystics achieve their mystical experience through prayer, and so do Muslims. And so prayer produces this particular feeling. And this particular feeling, this is the wine of the Sufis. Now, we're going to read a little Omar Khayyam, both Fitzgerald's Victorian Western version of Omar Khayyam and also the actual version of Omar Khayyam. Omar Khayyam, as you remember, was a Persian Sufi and a poet, mathematician, and a good friend and college buddy of the old man of the mountains, Ibn Saba, the head of the assassins, and from which we get the term hashashin, which we get the term hashish. And the prophet forbade tobacco and forbade wine. But that's where he stopped. He didn't forbid anything else. So the Sufis, when they talk about wine, they're not talking about wine as wine in the Sufi poetry and in Sufi stories and Sufi parables and all that. They're talking really about the mystical experience. And Sufi rituals are designed to create the mystical experience, to get to get you into that perfect state. Well, there's a line, I think, in one of the OTO rituals, because the OTOs, Carl Kellner and Crowley and everything, they were influenced to some degree by the Sufis. And one of the Sufis is quoted in there as saying, "There is nothing in my turban, but my turban is wrapped in nothing around, nothing but God. There's nothing inside my turban but God." In other words, he has completely lost his individuality and he has become one with the entire universe. But this is just the classical mystical experience. So this is what there are more Muslims, because they do get down on their knees and put their head on the floor and pray five times a day, they're certainly going to have more mystical experiences than we have. I mean, that's a given. Yeah, that's obvious. Because what they're doing is, in a sense, a form of bhakti yoga. But it's bhakti yoga that on a non-specific deity, on God, on the one universal, ineffable, and that's, so you do it. Usually, if you're going to do bhakti yoga, you do it on a particular entity. You do it on a which, and entities are used, you shouldn't call it paganism, because we use them symbolically. We create our own archetypes in this respect. So using that, but that's different. But still, regardless, this is a form of bhakti yoga. So we have a built-in mystical engine in Islam, and the Sufis are grew out of this. And so I don't think that we should look for the origins of Sufism outside of Islam. This is where it gets started. Now, what they did is find other ways that are right along with the five daily prayers, but that sort of thing that also creates the mystical experience and amplifies it and perhaps intensifies it. And that's what they're doing. So what they will do is, when they get in their circles, they will chant the 91 names of God. I think there isn't any one of them. I've got Hulse's big sheet of it all sitting over here, and when I start getting into Abjad and what have you, I'll go in and dig into Hulse. But they have all these names of God, these permutations, and they'll sit there and they'll chant these, and that'll get them there, and that'll get, you know, and then the whirling dervishes, that's a Sufi order in itself, and they spin around, and of course they spin and spin and spin, and they wear those nice white, you know, kind of outfits with a spinning skirt and whatever, and they spin and whirl and whirl and whirl, and they spin themselves into a mystical experience. They dance, and then there's another Sufi order that they have a musical instrument, kind of like a lute, and they sing, and they sing and play this musical instrument that's kind of like a lute, and as far as they're concerned, they can do that five times a day instead of praying, and that's where their way of getting into them is this thing. But the idea of all of this is to achieve this particular mystical state. That's what they're trying to do. They're not trying to practice magic. They're not casting spells on anybody. But at the same time they're doing this, they are trying to bring the waking person, the person, the everyday person who is a Sufi, to perfect himself or herself to where they live a really good life and a productive life, and they do something worthwhile. This is why Sufis extol jobs like craftsmanship. To a Sufi, being a good shoemaker is a great deal more important than being a good banker or being a good manager of a company or something like that. That's not that. The Sufi extols the simple life a productive life, doing something well, and that helps people, and being a very charitable, very loving, a very giving person. They're not materialistic at all, and they want to achieve a perfection of to be at peace with themselves and at peace with other people, and to be able to become their experiences with one with God. And all of this is really, how can one possibly fault it? How can one look at this as being wrong or bad or anything? I think personally, I've had mystical experiences and all that. I think they're wonderful. I'm still primarily a magician, but I think theurgy is a part of magic. And I think personally, now in studying the history of Sufism, there's a few. If you look into it, you think that the Sufis had some influence on Kabbalah, and they did. And I don't think there's any doubt about this. That they did, because for one thing, the Hebrew actually needed an Arabic grammar, and Arabic, of course, the Hebrew is an older language in one way, but it had, in order to bring it up to where it could be used in the Middle Ages, they constructed it on an Arabic grammar. Now Arabic, following Mohammed and under Mohammed's inspiration, Arabic was a language that was created and actually created to be a mystical language, a magical language. It was given 28 letters. Why? Because they wanted a letter for each mansion of the moon. Now, just thinking about the implications of that, Arabic also, as you know, the Arabs were great mathematicians, and the Arabic has the numerical equivalents. Now, actually, the Hebrews got their numerical equivalents from the Greeks. We know that. But they also got some of their relationships from Arabic when they used Arabic grammar to create modern Hebrew. When I say modern Hebrew, I mean it was in medieval Spain, actually. And in medieval Spain, as you probably already know, that very, very sophisticated and civilized caliphate in Spain until the dirty, unwashed, illiterate Christians ran them out. They had these wonderful universities where Sufis and Hebrew Kabbalists and rabbis and Christian scholars, and everybody could teach at these wonderful universities they had. And I think personally that Abraham Abulafia, who was the Kabbalist who had the practical, what we call magical and mystical exercises in the Kabbalah, in the medieval Kabbalah, Abulafia, I think he was influenced by the Sufis. Because Abulafia was the Kabbalist who developed this idea of repeating over and over and over again the various permutations of the Tetragrammaton, which, by the way, we still use today for healing rituals and one thing or another. My very good friend, colleague, and sometimes mentor, Merrick Hamer, is wonderful at that. He can roll off permutations of the holy name
virtually endlessly. I mean, and it's very, very healing and transforming. But I think the Sufis influenced Ibrahim Abulafi. I really do think they did. And because one of their main rituals is the repetition of the permutations of the holy name of Allah. And this mysticism and the mystical and the life and the perfect life and the life of service, the life of love, the life of productive, humble service is very important to them. So there's two aspects of it here. The number one is achieving this mystical experience as often as one can handle it. And the second object is perfecting yourself as a good and holy person. That's the two objects that they have. And I'll also say this. See, Islam, on the one hand, Muhammad, if you read the Quran, you become aware that Muhammad was actually more learned than a lot of people think. And he was aware of what we call the great Hermetic secret. And in fact, he even said once in the Quran, he said, "We are all descended from one soul." Now, so the Prophet, peace be unto him, did realize the big secret that we have in Hermetic philosophy, but this is something that Orthodox Islam, just like Orthodox Christianity and Judaism, don't like to have people become too much aware of. And the reason is, of course, if you start realizing that the only place you're ever going to find God is inside yourself and you're the center of the universe, this can be a big, huge ego trip for people who aren't ready to handle it. And so the Orthodox religion is they want to keep this down. And the same thing in Islam. This is something. So Orthodox Islam promotes the idea that you are a slave of God, the Ansar, the slaves of God. And it's kind of enforced humility. And this is a counter foil to the obvious or the possible ego inflation of realizing that nobody has any more God inside them than you do, and if you got God, you're it. You know, I mean, and they don't really want you in Orthodoxy. They don't want you dwelling on that. They don't want you doing it. So the Sufis are also the same way. The Sufis are. They don't emphasize this aspect of the personal attainment this personal attainment of spirituality. They really go along with the humility of the whole process, and I think this is to their credit because proper enlightenment, regardless of how much you may realize you're the center of the universe, if you achieve this in the proper manner, and you achieve it through study, and you're led to it by a master who leads you along the right way, then when you attain it, this enlightenment, you realize that, hey, I'm just a tiny little godlet in the middle of this vast, huge universe, and there are godlets out there, little godlets, human godlets, that are so much smarter and better than I am, and maybe they don't even know it yet, but they are. You have to, you are overwhelmed when you treat true enlightenment. True enlightenment overwhelms you and should make you relatively humble. I joked about it one time. I said, "Yes, I have transcended self-deification." So the Sufis are not, none of them, but they just do not get on this overblown ego thing. I think somebody like Crowley, and I don't mean to rag on Crowley, because Crowley believed that he was the smartest man in the world, probably because he couldn't find anybody that he really believed was any smarter than he was. I'm sure there were people that were, but you know, you don't find that. You do not find this in the Sufis. They will carefully lead, the Sufi master will carefully lead his students to a proper humility when they get to the point where there's nothing inside their turban but God. They'll be humble about it because they've been led that way properly. I'm very sympathetic to these people, and I just really feel there's about 20 to 30 million of them in the Islamic world. There are lots of them, but right now they're really being persecuted. They're being persecuted worse by the militant elements in Islam than we are. You know, you think the militant the militant elements in Islam, and many of them are very powerful, of course, you would think that they would hate the West more than anybody else, but actually I think in some ways they hate the Sufis worse than they do us, and worse than they do the pork-eating crusaders. They blow up Sufi mosques and shrines, and they run suicide bombers against them. They've been trying to wipe Sufism out. So for a minute, let's talk about that a little bit. It's kind of the controversial end of this because one of the most militant Islamic sects, if you want to call it a sect, that persecutes the Sufis and also supplied most of the bombers most of the suicide bombers that knocked down our two towers and hit the Pentagon, is a cult called the Wahhabis. And they happen to be, unfortunately, the leading Islamic religion in Saudi Arabia. In fact, they are almost what you might call the official church of Saudi Arabia. And they spend, unfortunately, they have a lot of money, of course, and so they support a number of groups in this country, which is unfortunate. And the Wahhabis are a militant, super fundamentalist Islamic sect that came up in the 1700s primarily against the Ottoman Empire. And that was their main target, was the Ottoman Empire, which was decadent at the time and whatever, and controlled most of the Arab world. So the Wahhabis rose up as a rebellion against the Ottoman Empire. Now, something that Stephen Schwartz didn't pick up on, mainly because he wasn't looking in the right place for it. So, Stephen, if you happen to be listening to this, you might want to make a note of this. The Wahhabis were over in India in the 1870s. And they murdered a British judge in Calcutta, all the way over there. And the British didn't like that very much. The British went on a campaign, and they ran the Wahhabis out of India, and they pushed them right through the Khyber Pass, right on up into those tribal areas. And the Wahhabis have been there ever since. So they are the
spiritual inspiration in many ways for the Taliban. Now, I mention this because these people are the ones who are also persecuting the Sufis. And in fact, there was a Sufi group up there in Afghanistan that was protecting those Banyan statues, the last of Shambhala, the last, you know, the huge Buddhist statues up there. And so, gosh, you know what happened to those statues? And that group somehow managed to survive. They're led by a woman, by the way. The Sufis are really being persecuted by the Wahhabis. And Stephen Schwartz, his book, The Other Islam, which is on modern Sufism and over there, stretching, going from the Balkans all the way over into Afghanistan. He doesn't discuss all the Sufi groups because, he's unaware of the ones he's aware of. And the book has leaves some things out. But it's an excellent, excellent book on the Sufis. And the criticism of it, if you read their reviews on Amazon, and I encourage you before you order the book to go and read the customer reviews on Amazon, and you'll see that Steve is being criticized for spending too much effort on going after the Wahhabis. And he even wrote a book, called The Two Faces of Islam Against the Wahhabis. And that's another one. If you buy into Stephen's criticism of the Wahhabis, and I'm not suggesting you do one way or the other, but that's his other book. The other is called The Two Faces of Islam, and that's but in The Other Islam, which is about the Sufis, he does spend a certain amount of effort describing the persecution that the various Sufi orders are undergoing these today. And so the Sufis need our support, and they really do. And we kind of consider them, in a way, they're kind of our spiritual brothers. And now, but I want to point out, too, as I said earlier, that there are neo-Sufi groups. Idris Shah is classified in that category. And the Golden Sufi Center, they published Peter Kingsley's book, Reality, by the way, which is just on early Greek philosophy. They're based in England, and I also have an outlet in this country. They had another one of their scholars, Inayat Khan. Oh, he did a little book on the tarot that I have, you know. So they're eclectic. Those Sufis are eclectic, but still, you should realize, though, with the Sufis, that Arabic is a difficult language to learn. It's a very difficult language to learn. I sure can't handle it, but that's the essence, you know. The Sufi rituals, speculations and the coding of Sufi poetry and a lot of things, Arabic is your core language. So if you're going to get into Sufism, you ought to, you know, consider that. Now, let's mention, we said that we were going to mention, or Jeff, some people, I imagine, think that Gurdjieff was a Sufi. Well, no, he really wasn't. But because Gurdjieff's system is, though, how primarily based on the Sufi idea. There's a minimum of doctrine and dogma and all that sort of thing. It's experiential, and as the Sufi, you know, as a Sufi system, it's experiential, and Gurdjieff teaches in kind of parables. So he had a lot of influence with the Sufis, but he also has some Nestorian Christian elements and one thing or another. So I wouldn't call Gurdjieff and Gurdjieffian groups necessarily neo-Sufi, although they have some relation to it. And, of course, Gurdjieff, as you know, liked dance. But Gurdjieff and this, you know, Gurdjieff's main thing was, wake up. We're all in all these various trance states walking around and don't know what's important in life, and we don't know what we ought to be doing, and we don't know how to achieve happiness and all that. And the main thing Gurdjieff wanted people to do was wake up. And, of course, you can say that Sufis do the same thing, although they do it in the structure of this Islamic mystical experience. Now, I said that I would compare Omar Khayyam and Omar the Tentmaker, Omar Khayyam to what we thought he said as opposed to what he really did say. Now, what really was the first big popular introduction to Sufism, or what some people think of Sufism in the West, was Fitzgerald's Victorian Age translation of Omar Khayyam's Rubaiyat, and which Omar Khayyam wrote in Persian, by the way. And so I'm going to read a little bit of this. I used to have a lot of this memorized. When I was in high school, we thought that this was great to recite to girls to kind of get them in a romantic mood, you see. We thought this that because Omar Khayyam, actually, there are people that wrote philosophy in philosophy books thinking that Omar Khayyam was really a hedonist, and that he was really a hedonist and a libertine. And they actually thought that that was what it was all about. Based upon, or Sufism was about, based upon Fitzgerald's translation. But that is not it, because when Omar is talking about wine, he is really not talking about wine. That's a Sufi code. But anyway, we'll read a little bit of this. Awake from morning in the bowl of night, from the stone that puts the stars to flight, and lo, the hunter in the east has caught the sultan's turret in a noose of light. Dreaming when dawn's left hand was in the sky, I heard a voice within the tavern cry, awake, my little ones, and fill the cup before life's liquor in its cup be dry. And as the cock crew, those who stood before the tavern shouted, open then the door, you know how little while we have to stay, and once departed may return no more. And then, to get more philosophical, with me along some strip of herbage strewn that justifies the desert for the sun, where Dave of slave and sultan scarce is known, and pity sultan bumbled on his throne. Lo, to the rose that blows about us, lo, laughing, she says, into the world I blow. At once the silken tassel of my purse tear, and its treasure on the garden throw. How? 'Tis all a checkerboard of nights and days with destiny, where destiny with men for pieces plays, hither and thither moves, and mates and slays, and one by one, back in the closet lays. The ball, no question, makes an eye as it knows, but right or left as strikes the player goes, and he that tossed thee down into the field, he knows about it all. Oh, he knows, he knows. Now the moving finger writes, and having writ moves on, nor all thy piety or wit shall writ back to cancel that line, nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. And that inverted bowl we call the sky, whereunder crawling cooped we live and die, lift not thy hands to it for help, for it rolls impotently on as thou and I. With earth's first clay they did the last man need, and then the last harvest sowed the seed.
Yea, the first morning of creation wrote what the last dawn of reckoning shall read. I tell thee this when starting from the goal, over the shoulders of the flaming pole of heaven, Erwin and Mushriti they flung, in my predestined plot of dust and sod. Okay, so, well, that's Fitzgerald, and that was virtually started a pseudo Sufi cult in the West. Let's read a little Omar Khayyam in a translation that is much, much closer to what Khayyam actually wrote. The secret must be kept from all non-people. The mystery must be hidden from all idiots. See what you do to people. The eye has to be hidden from all men. The circle of this world is like a ring. There is no doubt at all that we are the Nashkri, the design of its bezel. In cell and cloister, in monastery and synagogue, some fear hell and others dream of paradise. But no man who really knows the secrets of his God has planted seeds like this within his heart. I drink wine, and opponents from right and left say, drink no drink, for it is against faith. And since I know that wine is against faith, my God, let me drink. The blood of the enemy is lawful for me. Though wine is forbidden, this is according to him who drinks it, and to how much also with whom it is drunk. And when these three requirements are fulfilled, speak truly then, if the wise may not drink wine, then who should? You are not gold, ignorantly, heedless one. That once put in the earth, anyone will bring you out again. Do you know what man of earth may be, Khayyam? A lantern of imaginings, and inside a lamp. Take some substance from here to there, and we'll make no profit if you go with an empty hand. Every clique has a theory about me. I am mine. What I am, I am. Now, that's real Omar Khayyam, or at least as close as we can come to it in English. It's somewhat different than Fitzgerald, although those verses don't directly parallel each other, because actually Fitzgerald took some of his poetry from Jami and other Persian poets, and they had decided to, you know, to present it as Omar. I'll tell you before we sign off, one of Nusrat Din's little humorous parables about Nusrat Din was a smuggler, and for years and years and years he smuggled, and this border guard, this particular customs inspector, kept trying to catch him. And every time Nusrat Din would go through the border with his caravan of donkeys, the customs inspector would search all the donkeys, and he'd search every, he would search the donkeys in their fur and in between their hooves and probably other places, and looking in their teeth. And he couldn't, and all the packs, and he never could find what Nuraldeen was smoking. Oh, I was smoking, excuse me. Oh, that's a Freudian slip. I mean, yeah, well, that's one of the secrets. Schwartz, you get Schwartz's book, and you'll know another Sufi secret, by the way. But anyway, they never could find out what Nuraldeen was smuggling. So finally the two of them retired, and they were in this coffee shop, and the customs inspector said, "Ah, Nuraldeen, we're both retired." and you're not smuggling anymore, and I'm not a customs inspector anymore, please, please tell me, what, in all those years, what were you smuggling? And the RLD looks at him and laughs and says, donkeys. Now, this is, I won't say this is typical, but this is the way Sufis teach. They have a wonderful sense of humor. Well, I hope I've at least introduced you a little bit to Sufism and some of the what we owe to it. We owe a lot to Sufism. We really do. And they are our friends, and we need to support the Sufis. So next week, going from the loving, compassionate, loving Sufis. Next week we'll deal with the other side of whatever. And next week it's the ninjas and their mystical system called Kuchikuri. So you want to deal with the secrets. We're going from the light side to the dark side. And so we'll see you next week. And hopefully we'll have some pretty experienced ninjas on tap, maybe to call in. So next week it's Togekuri Ryu Ninjutsu. And we'll see Ben. And meanwhile, good magic.